Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. According to the CDC, nearly one in five women in the United States report having been raped at some time in their lives. As more and more women who've been sexually assaulted and raped bravely tell their stories, how are the media reporting what happens after they go public with the crime and maybe even go to police? In the new book, A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, journalists T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong illuminate the disturbing reality of how our society, especially law enforcement, treats survivors of sexual assault. They also explore the long history of skepticism toward rape victims. Today, we are joined by T. Christian Miller, a senior reporter for ProPublica. In 2016, he and journalist Ken Armstrong won the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting on sexual assault, and their book is going to be turned into a Netflix series. T. Christian Miller teaches data journalism at UC Berkeley, and he joins us from Berkeley. Hi, T. Welcome to the show.
Hey there, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You know, I read your book in one sitting. I could not put it down. It was so disturbing, but so well reported. Before we dive in and talk about that, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So what caught your attention this week?
I think a story that has resonated for me most this week is the CIA appointments. I mean, it's always hard to pick nowadays because there's so much news every day flowing all the time. But the movements at the CIA and the State Department and the coverage that's been done by the New York Times or the Washington Post week in and week out has just been a professional pride, been amazing to watch those two giant news organizations really go toe-to-toe week after week in the best tradition of competitive journalism and dig up information that we all need to know about the presidency.
And we'll be talking in about 40 minutes with the nation's Eli Clifton about those huge stories that broke this week. And actually, we're waiting for other breaking news about perhaps John Bolton might be joining the Trump administration, but we'll talk about that later in the show. Diving in and talking about your book, in reading this, I learned so much about rape kits, about the history of law enforcement not believing women, just about what happens behind the scenes after a woman tells law enforcement that she has been raped. What did you know about these issues before you started reporting on sexual assault and rape?
I've been a journalist for 25 years and I've covered a lot of criminal justice, cops and crime beats. So I knew in general what rape examination is like. But when you really dig in to what a woman has to endure in order to bring her crime forward to the prosecutors and the police, the amount of the rape examination itself is a 4-hour-long examination, involves collection of all kinds of samples. It's in itself been described as a second trauma that someone would have to go through because it has to happen right away. It has to happen immediately after the sexual assault or as soon as possible in order to collect the best evidence. And so when you see figures about that only one of 100 rapes ends up getting prosecuted, and many women do not report their sexual assault or rape. When you see kind of the enormous hurdles, and they're necessary. I can't criticize that they occur. You're trying to collect evidence, but when you see just how difficult it is to go through the criminal justice system, to be questioned by a defense attorney about all sorts of aspects of your life, to have to kind of face your accuser and sit down in a courtroom, perhaps feet away. Any woman who has the strength and the resilience to go through that process deserves praise because it is a tremendously invasive and difficult and lengthy period of time. So that's one of the things that was struck me when I was through with the story is that it is amazing, really, that there are any women or men who are sexually assaulted who want to come forward and go through this entire system because it is by the nature of our system, by the nature of we seeking proof, it is just an exhausting process to go through.
So exhausting. In some cases, the women that you wrote about had to tell their stories 5-6 times. You talk about how that is a second trauma, and then if they're not believed, that is a third trauma.
Oh yeah, I mean, like every step of the way, you can encounter. So in our book, in our book, we talk about Marie, who was the kind of the victim who came forward and wasn't believed by the police, and that her story kind of will tell you all the ins and outs of what can occur. So she initially came forward to, she reported her rape. She was raped by a stranger in her bedroom. She had marks on her wrists that were obvious. There were physical signs that the rapist had broken into her house. She comes forward to police, and within a day or two, the police stop believing her account of actually being raped and begin to believe that she has made up the entire incident. And they pressure her to a degree where she ends up signing a confession that indeed she didn't. She wasn't sexually assaulted. And then she comes back and tries to change that, and then she's forced to change it a third time. And then she finally ends up getting charged for making a false report to the police, which is a crime. And it takes years before she clears it off her record. So that whole process, again, I mean, it's not like people don't know that occurs, it's not like women don't hear that happens. It just makes it very difficult to come forward.
You mentioned Marie. She's 18 years old. Well, the story at the time, she was 18 when this happened. She has moved from one foster home to another. She's experienced major trauma in her life, sexual abuse before she was raped, a very strong and determined young woman. She had her own place in 2008 in Linwood, Washington. And she told police that a stranger with a knife entered her apartment while she was sleeping, tied her up with one of her shoestrings, blindfolded, and then gagged her. He took photos of her and threatened to post the photos online if she went to police. When you first heard about this case, why did you become interested in pursuing it further?
So there's a couple reasons. I had been doing stories as part of ProPublica, series of stories on how police can improve their handling of investigation of sexual assaults. In the course of reporting that story, a source of mine said, you should go look at a case where the prosecution was done quite well, the investigation prosecution was done quite well in Colorado, and a rape case in Colorado involving a serial rapist by the name of Mark O'Leary. So I was reporting that story about how the police had managed to do this amazing work to capture Mark O'Leary. But Mark O'Leary's first victim, as it would turn out, this is a spoiler alert, but it would turn out was Marie. And so that led me to Marie. And as it happened, my colleague, Ken Armstrong, had seen Marie's story, and he had been intrigued by the idea of false reporting and being arrested for false reporting. And so he had begun reporting on Marie's case. And so we kind of met in the middle. I called Marie's attorney, and the attorney said, well, I don't know why you're working on this. There's already somebody else working on this. And from that point in time, Ken and I began working together to excavate this case. Now, one of the things that's always been one of the, in the back of my mind, or a guiding principle, really, in reporting this, is that Marie's case is unusual. I mean, most sexual assaults, most rapes happen between acquaintances. Mm-hmm. There's not violence often involved. So Marie's case is a case where if you don't believe Marie, who was violently sexually assaulted, had proof of the sexual assault, had immediately reported the sexual assault, if Marie has trouble convincing police that she was sexually assaulted, then imagine how much more difficult it is for the typical sexual assault, which doesn't feature any of those things, where it's a acquaintance and there's not a lot of signs. So our point is always that the extreme kind of proves the mean, which is that women who don't have such clear signs face even greater hurdles than Marie did. And how shocking is that?
I mean, you have to read the book to really learn about what really happened with Marie, but if you had to summarize it, why do you think the police didn't believe her?
There's a couple of reasons. One of the important ones that can often get overlooked is that as the police began investigating Marie's account, Marie had two foster mothers whom she was quite close to. And the foster mothers themselves began to have doubts about Marie's account. One of them thought that Marie wasn't acting as a rape victim should act. She herself was a sexual assault survivor, and she'd had a very different reaction than Marie had had. There were questions about kind of some of the ways she was acting. She was sort of seemed almost flirty and giggly after the sexual assault. And so these two foster mothers, who knew Marie quite well, actually one of them called the police department and expressed their concerns, saying that I'm not sure that Marie was believed. Now, it is definitely the police officer's job to weigh that and, you know, figure out whether or not they think that's true. But that helps plant a seed of doubt within their own minds about what Marie was telling them. So, you know, you have an officer who's being told by foster mothers that the foster mothers themselves disbelieve the rape. You had a police officer, one of the investigating officers, had very little experience in sexual assault investigations. Mm-hmm. He may not have known, for instance, like one of the things we find out in the book is there is no standardized way that a person reacts to being sexually assaulted. Being giggly and laughing afterwards is a reaction you see. Screaming and being incredibly upset is a reaction you see. Being emotionally flat and affectless is a reaction you see. So it was combined with sort of some of Marie's, the policeman's, the cop's own biases about what rape should look like, the foster mother's thinking of what rape should look like, those kind of combined to create this doubt that then became its own investigation and switched the investigation from the accusation of sexual assault to investigating a false accusation. And to their credit, the Lynwood police have acknowledged that was a complete error and a mistake, and have taken reforms in their own department to prevent that from happening again.
Hmm. Because Marie was sexually abused before being raped and moved from one foster home to another, which is in many ways a traumatizing experience for a young person, and she was dealing with so many things, she basically was tired of dealing with it and said she lied about being raped. And then what's so incredible and scandalous is that she would be charged with lying to the police about being raped. I didn't even know this was possible.
Right. I mean, it actually, there are no good statistics about how often that occurs, but almost every cop that we talk to, there's a story, has their own story about filing an accusation, a false accusation, filing a charge on that case, because it does happen. I mean, there are certainly men and women who come forward and are lying about sexually assaulted for many different reasons. And in some cases, that can involve a lot of time and manpower and investigation. And you want to discourage, obviously, police from wasting their time and effort on somebody who's lying. And so that's why it exists, and that's why at least some agencies will file a charge of filing a false police report. Now, I hasten to say that there are other agencies which have decided that's, as your amazement indicates, that's not really a worthwhile thing to pursue, and that it's more important to kind of maintain a very open relationship with the community. And so, yes, sometimes you'll have people come and lie to you, but the risk of that is less than the benefit of having an open communication with your community, so that people aren't scared that if they come in and talk to the police, they might end up getting arrested if the police don't believe you.
What really struck you about the officers involved in these cases? It was so interesting to learn about their lives, why they do this kind of work, how in many cases they work 24/7 to try to help these women. What really stood out for me were the women officers. And you write in your book, A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, that female officers have been shown to respond more effectively to violence against women. Not really surprising, but there's data. For instance, a 1985 study found that female officers displayed more patience and understanding with domestic violence victims. A 2006 study of the 60 largest metropolitan police departments showed that every 1% increase in female officers correlated with a 1% increase in the number of rapes reported in a jurisdiction.
Yes, and I don't think anybody is necessarily going to be surprised that female officers may have exhibit a little more sort of empathy, because most rape victims, of course, are females, and I don't think anybody is surprised that there may be a sort of a more direct connection to. But what the two female officers who led this investigation in Colorado, who just like you said, went 24/7, did some extraordinary investigative work. Most of the team that was working with them was also females. There were also several male officers as well. But what's Edna Hendershot and Stacey Galbraith, who are the two detectives, female detectives, will tell you is that they think there is certainly something to that, but the most important factor is not really the gender of the officer, but it's the officer's commitment to investigating sexual assault. And there are plenty of great male detectives who would work just as hard and do just as much as Stacey Galbraith and Hendershot had done, but that really the most important factor is, do you care enough to do justice for a man or woman who has been sexually assaulted?
Today we are joined by T. Christian Miller, a senior reporter for ProPublica. In 2016, he and journalist Ken Armstrong won the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting on sexual assault. Ken Armstrong is co-author of the book. He's now a senior reporter at ProPublica. The book is called A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. And it's really an incredible book. I read it in one sitting. It reads kind of like a crime novel, and you have to remind yourself that this actually happened. They illuminate a very disturbing reality of how our society, especially law enforcement, treats survivors of sexual assault. They also look at the very long history of skepticism toward rape victims in this country. Really interesting information about rape kits and just how these cases are investigated. Because this is now getting attention with Me Too and so many brave women sharing their stories publicly, what are your thoughts on how this is being reported? If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Sometimes it's just really hard to get all the information in one article, and this book just really gives you a wide picture of how rape is dealt with in this country. You know, I don't want to give away too much, T, and I also just should have, I'm sorry, I should have told listeners that we're going to talk about some disturbing content here because a lot of these things are triggering for so many people. But I do want to ask you about the rapist, Mark O'Leary, because this story is just incredible. You know, in many cases, you hear about people who rape and inevitably they have some kind of abuse happening in their background, like they were abused as children. This was not the case with Mark O'Leary. He's a former member of the military. He was stalking women in Washington State and Colorado from at least 2008 to 2011 when he was finally caught. And I mean, it's just, it's really horrific. He drove around neighborhoods. He searched for women who lived alone in poorly lit ground floor apartments with sliding doors. Sometimes he observed them for weeks. He knew a lot about them. He was very meticulous. What really struck you about Mark O'Leary?
I think you've summarized it quite nicely. He called himself a student of rape, and he really studied. He actually, at one time, he bought a book that many is taught at police academies called the Rape Investigation Handbook, which is what police use to kind of study how to do rapes. And so he would read that book and figure out like how he could avoid the cops. And he was very incredibly meticulous and thoughtful about his planning, so that he would try to, when he would, you know, as you said, he would stalk for an area for months, and he, and not just one house. He would go through like house to house to house until he found a victim where he could observe them, what they're doing, and realize they had some kind of security flaw that he could get into. He would study them then online. He would break into their houses before the rape and like steal, you know, look through material to kind of learn more about them. He would deliberately commit sexual assault in different jurisdictions, because he knew that police sometimes do not communicate across jurisdictional lines, and so he deliberately would pick, oh, this is a sheriff's office here, and here's a city police department here, and here's a county here. So he would really study how he could get away. He would collect all the DNA material that he could possibly collect from the apartment, like the bed sheets and anything else. And so he was a student of rape, and he really made it his. That's what he did. He was married. You know, he had a wife. He kept that, as far as we can tell. He kept that completely secret. His family didn't know about that. I just want to correct one thing. Not correct, but so we don't have Ken and I in our book didn't find any kind of history of abuse with Mark O'Leary. That doesn't mean it didn't occur. Mm-hmm. Mark O'Leary is you can't necessarily trust what a convicted serial rapist says, mm-hmm. of course. And he describes his home life as being very, you know, loving and normal. That's what he says. I can't sort of attest there wasn't anything behind the scenes that we don't know about, because it's not like his folks didn't particularly want to talk to us for the story, and we didn't find any signs of it, but just everything that Mark O'Leary says, you have to kind of take, I think, with a grain of salt.
I'm really glad you said that, because I wondered, was this man abused as a child? You were able to interview him. Did you ask him?
Oh, yeah, we definitely did. We interviewed him, in fact, we interviewed him for about 4 hours in prison in Northwest Colorado, where he is now imprisoned for 327 years. And then the FBI had actually done a post-conviction interview with him to kind of learn for the behavioralists, the guys who were in Silence of the Lambs. They were maybe going to interview and talk to him about his particular predilections. And so we had that too. And in both those interviews, there's a, you know, what's your background like? And he describes himself as having had a very normal and loving childhood. And from the, there are some statements that his family made, for instance, to the press or to in a courtroom setting. And there's also no indication there. I mean, the mother had an opportunity to talk about her son, and she certainly could have referenced abuse in the past, but she chose not to. So we don't really 100% know. I mean, O'Leary's own story is that he always was fascinated to humiliation and degradation of women, and that he recalls this moment when he saw a Star Wars movie with Princess Leia being chained in a bikini, chained up to Jabba the Hutt, and like realizing at that moment that that's what he wanted. He wanted fear from women to gratify himself. Again, like, take it with a grain of salt, but that's his own story.
Well, and the other thing, an important point you write about in your book, O'Leary wonders if he could have been stopped years ago if there had been a program to intervene with young boys suffering deviant fantasies. He said there's no safe haven for a person that is on the edge or knows that they're going down the wrong path to really go and say, look, I need help. A program's success would depend on counselors who understand the urge to rape, people like him, O'Leary said. I don't care if you had 20 PhDs on your wall or were an expert in criminology or psychology. There's no way I would have opened up completely.
Right, and that's a point that his mother has also made. And, you know, you can't dismiss it. There aren't a lot of programs that are, you know, directly targeted toward young boys becoming men who have deviant fantasies. I mean, it's obviously, I mean, very difficult to come forward about anything involving sex when you're a teenager, mm-hmm. and also to have deviant fantasies and sort of where is the place where you could talk about that? To whom would you discuss that and not feel ashamed or afraid of getting arrested or whatever else? So that was O'Leary's point, is that there isn't any kind of a place where you could perhaps intervene early and try and head off a potentially developing serial rapist.
He will be in prison for the rest of his life. Is he getting any help?
You mean like internal? No, I don't think so. When we talked to him, trying to remember now if he told us anything special about that. He described his day specifically as being like he reads lots of books and he, you know, keeps to himself and he tries to stay out of trouble. He will not leave prison. So in our current prison complex, there's not a lot of sort of self-help that's made to people who are in prison for life, because I think there's a feeling of like what's the point. But I can't quite fully answer that question.
T. Christian Miller is a senior reporter with ProPublica. He co-wrote the book A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America with Ken Armstrong. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 and again at noon, it's 1A with Joshua Johnson. Domestic focus on the first hour, international in the second hour. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by T. Christian Miller, a senior reporter with ProPublica. He and journalist Ken Armstrong wrote an incredible book, A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. We have about 10 more minutes, T, and I want to make sure that we talk about the women who were raped by this man. Some of them spoke at his hearing. You also interviewed them. What really stood out for you? I mean, you talked about them being traumatized many times, and you know they still live with the fear. Some of them don't go out at night anymore. They are afraid when they take showers. What really stood out for you about the trauma that they're dealing with? T? Sorry, go ahead.
So just a quick correction. We actually did interview the four women involved. They were... We asked if they wanted to be interviewed, and none of them wanted to, and we respected that decision. So the reporting that's done on them is from remarks they made in court or in public records in other places. And we took a lot of we made a strong effort to make sure that they were completely anonymous and changed all their names and ages to protect their wishes. But what clearly stands out is that each of these women did react to the sexual assault in different ways. So one of the women from Golden, Colorado, she was very stoic and didn't display a lot of emotion, but she was exceptionally intelligent in her efforts to gather as much evidence she could about the person who was raping her. So during the sexual assault, she was studying. He would wear a mask, so she was studying his body for details that she could later share with the police, and she noticed that he had a mark on his leg that ended up being a crucial part of the story later on. Other women were just remain to this day kind of emotionally devastated and have been treated for post-traumatic stress disorder and depression and anxiety. And so, this is a crime which now occurred almost 7 years ago, mm-hmm. And yet she's still dealing on a daily basis with results from that trauma. You had another woman who actually wasn't sexually assaulted. He broke into her house and he was about to sexually assault her, and she managed to fight him out and jump out a window and run away. That's another reaction one sees. So in the universe of the victims in this story, you see really the incredible diversity of reaction, the incredible diversity of response to what a sexual assault is like. And I just think that's one of the key overriding messages of this book, is that you to leave your expectations of what a rape victim, how that victim should behave, you leave those at the door, mm-hmm. and you follow the clues where they may lead.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about how this issue is being reported now that it's getting so much attention with the Me Too campaign?
It's a really good question, because I've been a journalist for 25 years, and I can say that when I started my career, it would have been very, very difficult to have done a story about a sexual assault or a rape which hadn't been investigated. In other words, where there wasn't some kind of a paper trail that said, the police have looked at this and they've said it was a rape, or they said it wasn't a rape. And now, today, you see a much greater willingness and understanding of the idea that you can report a sexual assault without having to rely upon necessarily what the police or prosecutors have told you. That's a very, as a journalist, you are taking greater risks in terms of you don't have any external sort of evidence to rely upon to back up your reporting. So it's incumbent upon you to do much more of the reporting to find out about the story of the victim and what's happened. And so that's a change, but I think that's all for the better. It's all for the better, because when I started as a reporter, you would only see or even think about reporting on a very small handful of rapes. And now you see a much greater willingness by the media to report an incident which necessarily wasn't ever reported to any official authorities, as most rapes are not. And you see also with that, as you mentioned, like women are more willing to come forward and talk about what happened to them, and in some cases even sort of put their names and to the victims, which is still not, 25 years ago, it would be extremely rare to ever see a rape victim want to be named in the newspaper or on TV. And now you're seeing women coming forward and saying, yes, that did happen to me, and here's my story, and that's nothing to be ashamed of. Mm.
T. Christian Miller is co-author of A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, an incredible book. You also write about the history of rape kits. In the mid-1970s, Martha Goddard formed a nonprofit in Chicago called the Citizens Committee for Victim Assistance. At the time, rape, steeped in stigma, received little attention. What attention it did get often did more damage than good. Goddard found allies for her cause. She was really focused on the enforcement of sexual assault laws. She connected with Sergeant Louis Vitullo, a microanalyst who was head of a crime lab at the Chicago Police Department, and he devised a blue and white cardboard box that standardized the collection of evidence in sexual assault cases. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a story that was sort of ironic because Goddard and Vitullo were developing this revolutionary idea at the time of having a standardized way of collecting evidence from a victim after a crime. Because what police will tell you is that in a rape scene, in a rape case, there are three criminal scenes. There's where the thing happened, there is the victim's body, and there's the rapist's body. And you need, and ideally, you can sort of get clues from all those different scenes, quote unquote. So they were standardizing this rape kit, and the ironic part of that story is that Goddard was looking for funding for this kit, and she found it at the Playboy Foundation at the time, and this is in the 80s, and she used the funding from the Playboy Foundation to help develop and spread this rape kit, and the idea took hold and began to go through different police departments one by one. And I think she told us some story about how she wasn't worried about the money from Playboy, but she would have never taken it from Hustler and Penthouse, which were two magazines which were a little more out there in terms of the pornography they would show. So it was kind of one of those stories from the 70s that, for those of us who didn't live through there, it makes you shake your head. But it really was. It was the rape kit movement took off as a result of Martha Goddard, Sergeant Vitullo, and the Playboy Foundation.
It's an incredible story. Before we let you go, T, according to End the Backlog, a campaign to enact comprehensive rape kit reform in every state, this is such a staggering number. 13,615 rape kits are untested here in California. And just recently, there was a press conference about this. Two bills in California have been introduced to put a limit on how long these test kits sit on the shelf. But why is this happening?
As your listeners may know, there was a case just in Berkeley about an untested rape kit in Berkeley that sat around and wasn't tested, and it later turned out that the individual murdered a woman. And California was not a focus of our reporting, and I was as surprised, I think, as anyone to find out that California had not been a leader in the testing of rape kits. I mean, there's many other states which have made it which has committed money and time and effort to test all the rape kits in their different police departments. Because once you test those rape kits, even if that doesn't lead to a clue in one case, it may lead to a clue in other cases as it gets entered into the FBI data sets, right? So I'm not familiar enough with the issue in California other than to say that I'm surprised that the state hasn't been a leader in reducing and eliminating the backlog of rape kits.
Well, we'll definitely do a show about it. And T, the book, your book that you wrote with Ken Armstrong, A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America, is slated to become an 8-part series for Netflix.
Yes, we're looking forward to that quite a bit. I think the plans are scripts underway, and they're writing things and hiring directors, and I think they're aiming for next year to be like an 8-part. It's a fictionalized version of the book, so I don't really know exactly how it will come out in the end, but it's being written by Suzanne Grant, who did Aaron Brockovich, and Michael Chabon and Ayelet Waldman are also involved in the project, so it's in just the best hands I can possibly imagine, and I'm going to be anxious to see it just as everyone else is.
Well, huge congratulations. I mean, it's what's great about this series is this is just going to elevate this issue even more, and more people will be educated about it. Like I said, I read your book in one sitting. So amazing. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Rose. It's been great.
Thank you. T. Christian Miller is a senior reporter with ProPublica. He and journalist Ken Armstrong wrote this incredible book, A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. They also won the Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Reporting on Sexual Assault. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Now I would like to welcome Eli Clifton to the show. Eli is a fellow at the Nation Institute and contributing editor at Loeb Log, and we're going to talk to Eli about all of the changes in the Trump administration, which continues to receive international attention. Hi, Eli. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Let's first talk about the firing of Rex Tillerson, which Donald Trump did over Twitter. There's been so much analysis and commentary about all of the new nominees, but what is your take on why he let Rex Tillerson go?
Well, it certainly seemed to be a firing that was a long time in the making. They obviously had butted heads for quite an extended period of time. And if nothing else, their sheer disconnect on messaging as well as on policy when it came to the administration's willingness or unwillingness, depending on the given day, to negotiate with North Korea and to have a direct meeting, in this case with Kim Jong-un, potentially, seemed to have played at least some role in the stated reasons that were given for his dismissal, namely that the president wanted to have a new team in place if and when this meeting with Kim Jong-un occurs. Now, as for the wider reasons of what was going on, I think I happen to buy into a lot of the analysis that suggests that simply at this point Trump is bucking the voices and people around him who he feels have constrained him at various points in time, specifically on national security and foreign policy matters. And that list goes beyond just Rex Tillerson. It would be extended to McMaster and to John Kelly, all of whom, if you read the tea leaves and read the latest rumors coming out of the White House, seem to have the expectation is that their days are numbered in the administration. Whether that means a matter of hours, days, weeks, or months remains to be seen.
Trump has nominated CIA Director Mike Pompeo to replace Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. You wrote a piece about this called Springtime for Irano-Islamophobes. Tell us a little bit about Mike Pompeo, where he comes from.
Pompeo, interestingly, comes out of Kansas. When you look at who were his congressmen from Kansas, and his when you look at who financed his campaigns, he received a lot of contributions from Koch Industries. Now, while the Koch brothers are often perceived as being a sort of the bogeymen of the right, and they certainly have played a very large role in forming the modern conservative or modern Republican movement, on foreign policy matters, they've often been at least seemingly very realist or libertarian is how some people would describe it, not necessarily attracted to the most hawkish agendas. And that's an interesting disconnect because Mike Pompeo, since he joined Congress, has come across as being extremely hawkish. And when you look at, in my piece, I reviewed a number of the things he stated over the years, those suggesting that even the Muslim American community has its own has problems with radicalization that need to be addressed by the community as a whole. Things that, as was pointed out by Peter Beinart in a piece that I think was published today, if you just swapped out Muslims for Jews or for Catholics, people would very quickly say these are very, very bigoted statements to be making. But the thing that really jumped out at me and the item that I think maybe hasn't gotten as much attention is that while there's lots of connections between Pompeo and well-known anti-Muslim advocates like Frank Gaffney at the Center for Security Policy, who promote these ideas that there's a vast Muslim Brotherhood conspiracy connecting pretty much every Muslim American group to the Muslim Brotherhood, I think there's something deeper going on with Pompeo. And to see that, you can go and review videos of him speaking at churches in Wichita. And there's a consistent message in there where he's portraying, it's not just about his views about Islam, it's about his views on Christianity. And that he seems to be espousing a view that Islam and Christianity are at war. In one group, one speech he gave in 2014, he told a Wichita church, this threat to America
is from a minority of Muslims who deeply believe that Islam is the way and the light and the only answer. They abhor Christians and will continue to press against us until we make sure that we pray and stand and fight and make sure that we know that Jesus Christ is our Savior and is truly the only solution for our world. Then a year later, he spoke at a different church, an evangelical church this time in Wichita, where he talked about attending morning sunrise prayer service on Easter in Baghdad with American soldiers, and talking about how the sun came up and we were in the middle of this ancient Christian place where our fellow followers are being tortured and beheaded and made to scatter from traditional Christian homes. Mm. But we were able to pray that day. We were able to pray that we knew Jesus Christ was our Savior. So there's a certain theme here of not just talking about, and he can, you know, talk about it in many different ways, about the threat of radical Islam. Sometimes he talks about it as being more broadly afflicting all Muslims. In some cases, he's very careful and says it's just a minority of Muslims. But there's also this certain Christian supremacist message that I think we need to look at more closely, especially now that he'll be very close to operating the handles of the national security of the United States and of American diplomacy.
Well, definitely looked at more closely. Eli, is this getting much attention in the wider conversation about this shakeup, the chaos that we keep hearing about at the White House? Are these videos and these comments being discussed?
Certainly the comments he's made and his ties to these anti-Muslim advocates are getting attention. I would be surprised if they do not come up in his confirmation hearing. And I think that those, coupled with his extreme hawkishness toward Iran, and the other thing that I think that sort of is a subtext there that doesn't get as much attention, is his extreme closeness to the Saudis and to the UAE, who have been making every effort they can to sort of fan the flames of a regional conflict, certainly in Yemen, certainly in Syria. But the goals here are obviously to try to push greater confrontation and conflict with Iran. And I think that when we talk about Pompeo's opposition to the Iran deal and the nuclear deal, needs to be put in the context of the fact that he's very close to and listens to people who are trying to encourage broader conflict and pressure against Iran that goes well beyond the JCPOA or the nuclear deal.
How do you think this will play out? What are you hearing from people in D.C. with so many hawks and former Bush era people now in Trump's cabinet? How do you think this will play out, especially when it comes to Iran?
It's very hard to tell, because so far on Iran, while we know that Trump has wanted to tear up the nuclear deal in as much as that is representative of U.S. policy towards Iran, because obviously it is broader than the nuclear deal, but in as far as he's wanted to do that, he's actually made very little progress. Now, the conventional thinking is that he's been held back by people like Rex Tillerson, by people like McMaster, by people who have explained to him that this will have dire consequences. And certainly the trend in his cabinet has been that people have threatened to resign if he takes X or Y step. Now, it seems as if the people who have been, for lack of a better term, the adult voices in the room, are being systematically removed at this point. And where that will take us and where this president is willing to go on his own and how much he's willing to listen to extremely hawkish advisors, some of whom are responsible for the policies under the Bush administration that he was very quick to denounce, I think that's anyone's guess. But we're moving in a very different direction at this point.
And Pompeo has voiced support for torture. He said he wants to keep the prison at Guantanamo Bay open. What else did you learn about Pompeo and torture specifically? Because Gina Haspel is the one that's getting the most attention when it comes to torture.
That's right. Well, he's certainly been one of the members of Congress who continued to voice the debunked theory that torture produced significant actionable intelligence, which has been at this point pretty well disproven. What has been shown is that conventional interrogation methods actually worked quite well with detainees from Afghanistan and Iraq, and that torture, while certainly implemented and used at black sites, such as the one in Thailand, that the presumptive new CIA director may have overseen or been involved in, actually produced very little useful information. And if anything, it stopped detainees from continuing to speak. So he certainly was one of the voices that said that this was important information was gained from this, which is interesting because he wasn't even in elected office at the time. And he certainly has been a fierce advocate of keeping Guantanamo Bay open, saying that, that it's the only option as a place to detainees and that it somehow would pose a dire national security threat if we moved detainees to federal maximum security prisons, which has also been shown that in terms of actual threats posed by moving an individual prisoner, it's probably relatively low.
Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute and contributing editor at the Loeb Log. One more thing on Pompeo. As you mentioned, he's the greatest beneficiary of Koch money. John Nichols in the Nation has a piece called The Koch Brothers Get Their Very Own Secretary of State. He was leading the CIA. We'll see if he becomes Secretary of State. 14 Democrats, including Chuck Schumer and Independent Senator Angus King, supported Pompeo to lead the CIA. Do you have any information about what they're planning to do on this vote? Chuck Schumer said on Tuesday, according to The Hill, that he was not actively urging his caucus to oppose Pompeo.
I mean, one would hope, based off of what I've seen, that you will see greater Democratic opposition to him taking on the role of Secretary of State. And I think that, you know, a key thing to understand here about why there might be greater opposition, or at least one reason that members of Congress, specifically Democrats, who have respected how these different offices function, might take issue with Pompeo moving to the State Department, is that, you know, the director of the CIA is not supposed to be somebody who is actually involved in shaping or advocating or engaging in policy debates. That's not something they're supposed to do. They're supposed to offer the best analysis that they can to the president and to other relevant actors so they can make the policy decisions. So at one level, it seems like, well, he's a little less threatening in that role as CIA director. But one thing that occurred while he was CIA director, and one of the reasons supposedly that he's, you know, was on Trump's shortlist to be the Secretary of State, was that in giving the intelligence briefings to Donald Trump in the Oval Office, Pompeo would regularly engage in discussions about policy, advocating certain policy measures, and showing an unusual, if not an unheard of, willingness to engage in these debates as a CIA director. So he definitely crossed the line in many ways of what one expects from a CIA director in that role. And I don't think there's any question that as Secretary of State, he would be able to shape and create U.S. policy.
Let's talk about Gina Haspel, who's been nominated to be the director of the CIA. There's been a lot of reporting on this. In the fall of 2002, she took over running the first CIA detention facility of the so-called War on Terror at the detention site Green in Thailand. The techniques approved for use in these interrogations included waterboarding, mock drowning, sleep deprivation, including at least one period of 47 days, confinement in a coffin-like box. I mean, the list just goes on. The New York Times, Gina Haspel, Trump's choice for the CIA, played a role in a torture program. And The Guardian has a piece, Torture Allegations Dog Gina Haspel, as she's poised to be the first female CIA head. What are your thoughts about how the media are reporting on her connections to torture?
I think that's a very important question, is how are the media reporting on the allegations of her involvement in torture? Because just today, there were some questions raised and some retractions made about the certainty that she was actually the station, that she was directing the torture that occurred at the facility in Thailand, or that she was in charge of that facility when that interrogations that were torture occurred. But that gets at why it's so hard to report about this, and frankly, why these hearings are going to be so challenging, is that the vast majority of this person's career is classified. And I don't know if I can't think of any parallel that comes to mind of somebody being nominated for a confirmable position whose work history and biography is so clouded by classification. Now, even things that are, you know, rumored to be true would be hard to confirm necessarily, even under oath, even under the circumstances of a confirmation hearing. So I think it's going to be a very interesting dance that occurs about how do members of Congress who want to address the concerns about her involvement in a classified torture program begin to nibble around the edges of what her involvement was, what her responsibility was, let alone what went on in this program, where the pieces that we've heard are deeply troubling. And it seems members of Congress who are Republicans even have expressed concern about the waterboarding and other forms of torture, or enhanced interrogation, as it was called, that went on.
Mm. You're talking about some reporting. You're talking about ProPublica, and we'll put a link to this piece. There was questions about whether she was involved with the Al-Qaeda suspect Abu Zubaydah, but ProPublica says it stands by its reporting that Gina Haspel pushed her bosses to destroy the tapes of Zubaydah's waterboarding, and they did. What are your thoughts on that? Just quickly, we're almost out of time.
Right, and that is a very important point, and one that I have not seen anything contradicting. That she certainly approved the destruction of the tapes of the waterboarding, and that is a part of the story that still seems to stand up, and that certainly deserves to be. She will be. I have no doubt in my mind she will be questioned about it. Again, the issues are that we're dealing with programs that were still classified, decisions that were made that are classified, and it'll be very interesting to see how both the news reporting about this, as well as members of Congress who have concerned about these programs, managed to get at the heart of what went on.
And the editor at ProPublica, Stephen Engelberg, also said that she was in charge of black sites when another detainee, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, was waterboarded three times. And ProPublica says it stands by that reporting.
Yes, that's another important fact in this, it would seem. But I keep going back to the fact that even though reputable news outlets can report these as fact, doesn't mean that she can't still hide behind the fact that some of this was classified.
So, Eli, if you want to speak out to your senators, now is the time to do it, right? Because do you know when this hearing's taking place?
I do not know the dates for when they're occurring, but it's certainly, I think these will be some of the most, certainly the most influential confirmation hearings we've seen for probably decades. And this is going to be not just a test of where this administration's foreign policy is headed, but also in many ways it's going to be an opportunity to relitigate some of the things that happened shortly after 9/11, the early stages of the war on terror, and some of the CIA's programs that people have, really, the American public, have the biggest concerns about.
Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute and contributing editor at Loeb Log. Eli, thank you for your reporting. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. You can sign up for our podcast, yourcallradio.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.